Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens, families, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield. Positive parenting is simply parenting that focuses on a loving connection with the child rather than using control techniques like punishment and shame. My Child's Different is Elaine Halligan's true story of her family's journey with a child who is different, like her son, Sam. She shares her journey of anguish and embarrassment to gradual discovery and growth. You experience the transformation of an angry, struggling child into a capable, reflective, wonderful young man. According to the U.S. Department of Education, 6 million kids receive special education. 1 out of every 10 under the age of 14 has some type of special need, which includes physical, cognitive, medical disability, or chronic life-threatening illness. Elaine Halligan joins us from London. Elaine, welcome to 411 Teen.
Oh, that's lovely, Liz. Thank you so much. It was such a lovely introduction, and I'm just delighted to be here all the way across the pond.
Yes. I read your book as I was sharing with you, and I thought it was very well done. So I commend you on that.
Oh.
It was real. You could feel, right, you felt like you were right there. Okay.
How kind of you to say that, because I honestly can admit it's probably one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life, besides parenting Sam, is writing the book.
Well, you did an excellent job on both fronts, okay?
Thank you.
You're welcome. What are the issues that you confronted when you recognized your son, Sam, was a different child? And I say this to help parents who may be experiencing similar, you know, situations.
It's a huge question. Maybe if I just put a bit of background towards it before I answer that question, because the issues were enormous. And as you say, this is a true story about my son, Sam, who is now a young adult. And what he had was a really tricky start to life. And whilst I sensed in the early days that something wasn't quite right, and I have to confess, it all started very early on at nursery school. And what would happen, Liz, is we would be met at the nursery school gate or door, and the nursery teacher would always say to me, "Mrs. Halligan, we have not had a good day."
Oh.
And so from the young age of 3, I kind of sensed that Sam was a little different. And it started off with, you know, we've had a bad day and Sam doesn't listen. He struggles to sit on carpet time. Actually, we think he's aggressive with other children. He needs constant attention. And I just got this impression that they were really struggling with Sam, and so all my antennae were out. So I can honestly say, Liz, in the early days, it was all behavior-related. People found him a real problem child. And things went from bad to worse. And if I can just share with your listeners that by the age of 7, my beautiful little boy had been excluded from 3 schools in so many years. And so as a parent, we ended up with a 7-year-old who was literally written off in society, labeled stupid, naughty, and silly, and his sense of self-worth was completely shattered. So the book it is a human interest story, and it's all designed to help other parents who have maybe difficult or different or challenging children, and it's to help them with positive parenting skills to ensure that their children can develop into thriving, resilient adults. and their potential can be maximized and their strengths can be unlocked. So I would say, to answer your question, in the early days, it was all behavior. We struggled to manage him.
Did you suspect anything before he went to nursery school or daycare?
So I didn't suspect much before nursery, but things came quickly unstuck. And I would say things unraveled fairly quickly. There were some signs looking back, but because Sam was my firstborn, I had nothing to compare to. And so looking back, the signs were definitely there with some delayed development. I would say he was late to walk, and he was also delayed to talk. So I had some concerns, and when he started nursery and it was clear that he was a really sensitive, very impulsive and intense child, I would talk to other parents and I would say, I'm not sure this is normal. And they would all give me the same response list. They would all say to me, oh, he's just a boy. Or, you know, there's no need to worry. Things will be all right. My son was just like that and everything's turned out all right. But I did worry because in the early ages, 3 and 4, Sam would be doing extraordinary things that I just sensed weren't normal. And I'll give you an example. I will never forget taking him to a birthday party. And Sam was very high energy. And whenever I gave him sugar, it was always as if we'd just set a rocket up his backside. He would just be incredibly energetic. And then suddenly I'd turn around and I'd turn back. And at one party, Sam was stark naked. He stripped all his clothes off and was running around the room naked, thinking this was hysterical. And guess what? All the other children were laughing at him. And the more they laughed, the more Sam played to the crowd. And so he became a bit of a classroom clown. And I do remember at that point other parents looking at me, and I think perhaps pitying me. Because secretly we thought it was quite funny, but actually, well, in hindsight, it wasn't funny at all, and it was just a way that Sam was desperate to get attention, and he would get attention any such way. So I can confess that when he started big school, after nursery, the alarm bells were ringing, but no one took me seriously. They thought I was an overly concerned mother, but deep down, my kind of gut instinct told me Sam was different.
What was the labeling process like, or his diagnosis? Because I know he carried a number of different diagnoses.
Oh, Liz, he carried so many labels and diagnoses. He became known as the alphabet kid. And it was really puzzling. And it's taken me, I think, 15 years to realize that although Sam has some specific learning difficulties, a lot of his behavior was due to huge anxiety in the classroom, not being able to follow instructions, not being able to process language. And the labels, I kind of say that these TLAs, I don't know whether you know the acronym, it's 3-letter abbreviations. He was just a child burdened with TLAs. And the labels range from ASD, Autistic Spectrum Disorder. And I'm sure some of these will be very familiar to your listeners, but I will
share them. Yes, share the acronyms.
The other acronym we got was ADD, Attention Deficit Disorder. Then we were told, Mrs. Halligan, I think he's got SID. And SID is sensory integration dysfunction. And Sam was a very sensitive sensory child. So an example is that, you know, he would put socks on one day and the next day he'd be complaining that the seam wasn't right. And he would make the most almighty fuss about the seams of his socks. The labels of clothes were incredibly itchy. He would complain about smells. We'd open the fridge and he'd say, oh my God, Mum, that cheese smells horrible. and he was hypersensitive to sound and touch and smell. So that one diagnosis I kind of understood. Then we were told, oh, actually, we think he's got ODD. oppositional defiance disorder, which is like a conduct disorder.
Mm-hmm.
It's a behavioral disorder. And, of course, at that point, if you do have a diagnosis of ODD, I think you feel very judged as a parent. You feel that this all boils down to you not doing a good enough job. No, the labels carry on, and I've got to give you another one, which is PDA. And it's not public displays of affection. It's pathological demand avoidance. And I think when I got that label, Liz, I remember distinctly just coming home and crying. And if you add into that dyslexia, dyspraxia, and language processing issues, Sam, oh my goodness, was a kid after 2 years of diagnosis and labels. He was a kid in the syndrome mix.
Mm-hmm.
And it was at that point that I just threw up my hands and said no more. We were getting label after label, diagnostic assessment after diagnostic assessment, and no one was telling me how I should parent this child.
Did you feel responsible? Because often when parents are confronted with these types of issues, they feel like they are responsible, that there's something that they did or did not do that caused or contributed to this behavior.
Well, in the early days, again, I have to confess, I did a lot of things looking back that definitely didn't work, but I just didn't know what to do. And I'm sure your listeners will recognize some of this stuff if they're really honest. But what did we do? We repeated instructions. Yeah, what parent doesn't?
Right.
We reminded. We cajoled. We bribed. We threatened. I became a shoutaholic. You know, I just didn't recognize myself. And at the time, I just thought I was being a good parent because my son needed to listen to me and he needed to be cooperative and follow instructions. But what I kind of failed to understand was that Sam's emotional backpack was overflowing regularly. And although I don't blame ourselves for what we did in the early days, I did start to question what we'd done to cause this behavior. And yes, I think as parents, we do take on huge responsibility, and I think I felt very judged by other people.
You're tuned into 411 Teen. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll return momentarily. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen, and I am talking with Elaine Halligan, author of My Child's Different. Elaine, would you identify the various educational services that you experienced? I mean, what were the key things that you think parents should consider when identifying possibly a preschool or a school?
Oh, another big question there. It took us years, I have to confess, to get the right educational provision. Because Sam, and I probably haven't mentioned this in the interview, actually what was determined that he was severely dyslexic. And his dyslexia was so severe and profound that he actually couldn't read or write, but had an IQ in the 140s.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about a hidden disability, and that's the issue with specific learning needs, is that they affect children who have who are very bright, very able, but it's a real hidden disability. So we spent years putting him in, I would say, in the wrong educational environments. And for Sam, he needed a specialist placement. Is that a term that's used in America?
Yeah. Specialist, yes.
Yeah. So see, he definitely needed a specialized environment where they had peripatetic support, where they had speech and language therapists, where they had occupational therapists. And the most important thing for Sam as he progressed through education was that we found an educational environment that really allowed children to explore their creativity. So I absolutely get how literacy and maths are fundamental. Yeah, but there's no way around it. We need a solid base in literacy and maths. But Sam didn't have that literacy base. And so we had to really access schools that had a varied creative curriculum. So we were fortunate, and we did access a specialized environment where they had, Liz, the most wonderful subjects on offer. They had design and technology. They had art and design, pottery, engineering, resistant materials, business studies, entrepreneurial skills. And that was when the magic started to happen, when we managed to find an educational system that just didn't focus on academia. Mm-hmm. And that is critical. So it's a really big question, Liz, and I think one of the biggest issues for families is just identifying the right school. And in Britain, all schools have a legal responsibility to offer works for that child, but in practice, it can be really difficult to access.
We have that similar experience here, too.
Yeah, really, really challenging. Funding's an issue here, and definitely in the UK, funding is a huge issue. Mm-hmm. But I would say to any parent, if you're looking at an educational environment, you need to pick an environment that, firstly, is positive. So we have schools in London that have more of an authoritarian way of disciplining, and that absolutely doesn't work for most children, and it certainly doesn't work for special educational needs children. So you need a kind of holistic environment that's going to think outside the box, that's going to really help your kids be problem solvers, creative learners, solution-focused. And I think you're looking at the non-traditional, mm-hmm. non-academic subjects in order to really maximize the strengths. And that was where the magic started to happen for Sam, getting him into the right environment.
And I think you used a key phrase there when you said maximize the strength, because that's what you really need to do. All children, all these kids have strengths. And if we can tap into the strengths, play down the weaknesses, then they can be successful.
I couldn't agree with you more. It's about creating happy, motivated learners. And mm-hmm. and we kind of lose the plot here in London, because the more pressure on these children to succeed, the less creative they can become. So, you know, my top tip for parents is please don't focus purely on achievement,
right.
because this leads to kids cheating, lying, giving mm-hmm. up, becoming risk averse, and we mustn't have our kids define themselves completely by their results. It's really, mm-hmm. really important. Liz, I call it the home curriculum. I don't know whether that makes any sense, but it's important to teach our children the soft skills in life. Because with all the artificial intelligence coming up and the way the job market is looking, a lot of the academic jobs won't be around in 10, 20 years' time. And what will be more important than ever is that we develop or help develop kids who've got emotional intelligence. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I'm just passionate about, is teaching the soft skills, the home curriculum, and ensuring parents don't just focus on academic achievement.
Well, I think, you know, when you are confronted with a child that is different, one that marches to a different drummer, it has an impact on the family also. Research indicates that marriages often hit the rocks in response to coping with a special child. Share with us how you parents supported each other and made it through and navigated through all of these pitfalls?
Gosh, that's another great question, Liz. You're absolutely right. The tragedy is that a lot of marriages don't survive the pressures of bringing up a special educational needs child. How am I going to answer that? Gosh, there's so many strands to that question.
Well, I think you have so many answers because you've been there and done that. And so you're here to tell the story. And I think the listening audience and parents and families can benefit from what you have to say.
Yeah. I think one of the most important things for my husband and I in order to cope with what we were dealing with was learning about positive parenting. And that for us was transformational. Because once we had a toolkit of skills to support Sam and we started to see better behavior, family life just changes and it became a little more harmonious. And so there were kind of three top tips that we kind of learned that definitely took some of the pressure off. And as we began to see more results, we just wanted to do more of it. And I would say the three things we did was we learned how to be more positive.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I know that sounds so simple, but let me explain what happens in society and certainly in family life, is we tend to have something called a negativity bias, which means inadvertently we're critical.
Right. Yes.
Of our children and of our partners.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting is we get more of what we pay attention to. But in family life and with our partners, we tend to notice when people get things wrong. I don't know whether that makes any sense.
Yes, we do.
Let me give you an example. I'll give you a very simple example.
Okay.
Your child comes in from school, and they hang their coat up. They do the right thing. They follow the rule and hang their coat up. And they come running into the kitchen, and they dump their shoes and the backpack in the middle of the floor.
Right.
What do we notice?
We notice them dumping that stuff in the middle of the floor.
and we kind of fail to notice what they're getting right.
Mm-hmm.
So inadvertently, we can be quite critical. And the reason for this is very interesting. There's a bit of our brain called the reticular activating system. I don't know whether you've heard of it.
RAS, yes, ma'am.
So the RAS is part of the brain that searches for whatever it is we're currently focused on. So if we're focused on a clean house, a tidy house, shoes in the shoebox and book bag on the table, we will notice when that's not done and we will filter out whatever we think is not so important. So that coat that's hanging up, we may not notice it.
Mm-hmm.
Another example of the reticular activating system, the RAS, is if you're buying a new car, you suddenly go into your local streets in your town, and let's say you're buying a Volkswagen Golf, you suddenly look around and guess what? There's more Volkswagen Golf than
right.
you realize.
Right.
You pull up at the traffic light, you look left, and all right, I don't know what side of the road it is. And you suddenly see a Volkswagen Golf, and you think, oh, I've never noticed that before. And then you notice your neighbor's got a Volkswagen Golf. And so what the RAS is doing is it's searching for whatever you think is important. And it's filtering out everything else. So in family life, the thing that really held my husband and I together was learning these skills of how to be more positive. And we just started looking for the good behavior because actually there was some good behavior.
Of course.
But we were not in the habit of focusing on it. We were so focused on what needs to be fixed. And if we spend all our time focusing on what needs to be fixed, we miss some of the other good behaviors.
And that's just in opposition of basic society. What do? We look at what's wrong. We look at what's
true,
wrong.
Isn't it?
Yes, it is. That's easier said than done. Yeah, how did you do that, though? It's not that easy to accomplish.
Said than done. Yeah, we need to train ourselves to look for 5 positives to every 1 negative.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some really fascinating research by John Gottman, who's over in Seattle from the Gottman Institute. He's a couples counselor. And he says that in order to keep a marriage off the rocks, your partner needs to hear 5 praises to every 1 negative, 5 to 1. And I think that's quite frightening, because in everyday life, I can assure you most of us are not praising 5-1.
No.
And so if a marriage to work needs 5-1, I can promise you that the growing souls of our young children need far more praises. They need 10 praises to every negative. And so what we need to do is start changing the way we talk to our children and to each other, and using the power of our language to get children to feel better about themselves. And we do that using a skill called descriptive praise. In everyday life, Liz, most of us evaluatively praise.
Mm-hmm.
And evaluative praise is the good boy, great girl, yeah. You're fantastic, you're amazing, you are just the best. You are a brilliant runner. And we all know the problem with evaluative praise is that children don't believe it. They may believe it when they're youngsters, but as they grow up, they start to look at you and go, what are you on, Mum?
Right.
You say, I'm a brilliant runner.
But
for goodness sake, I came third in the running race. What are you talking about?
Right.
So that evaluative praise doesn't work. So what we need to do, and I'm going to give your listeners some top tips here. What you need to do is praise descriptively, describing what the child is doing and looking for four areas. You look for effort, you need to look for attitude, you need to look for any progress, any improvement the child's making, and also, you know, point out their qualities and characteristics. So a simple example would be, you know, if they have come in from school and hung the coat up, we would say, hey, Sam, good for you. You're already following one of the three rules you need to do when you come in from school. Your coat is in the right place. You're a boy getting into good habits and behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder which thing you're going to do next.
Ah, I'm sure
that's very... Can you see what we're doing there?
Yeah.
Instead of focusing on the negatives, we're commenting descriptively and praising on the one thing he's got right, which shows us that he remembers the rule, which shows us that he's in good habits and behaviors. He then feels good about himself. He then feels motivated. And we say to him, I wonder which thing you're going to do next. And the chances are that he may go and put his shoes in the shoebox.
Mm-hmm.
So without us having to nag and repeat, we can get our children more cooperative by pointing out the effort, the attitude, any improvement, and qualities and characteristics. Does that make sense?
Yes, it certainly does. Did you find a school environment that was willing to use that technique? Because when you get into the school, it's mostly negative. Stop, don't, do, you know, that kind of thing.
So when we did find a school environment that worked for Sam, the first thing we did was we offered them a teacher training course. because what I should say is, as a result of writing the book, or as a result of not writing the book, of bringing up Sam, we set up a business in London called The Parent Practice. And we offer positive parenting skills to parents and also teachers. So very cleverly, we managed to sell a teacher training course into the school that I went to. And we trained all the teachers in how to use the power of their language differently and to descriptively praise.
That's great. It sounds like it was very effective because he certainly has, you know, blossomed. So something was very, very effective.
But, you know, for parents out there who obviously can't do that, it's not about changing the school per se. It's about sharing with the school what's working at home.
Mm-hmm.
So another big top tip I've got is I encourage all parents with kind of primary school children. I'm not sure how that translates into the American school system, from kind of 5 to 11.
Okay, primary, elementary.
Elementary, absolutely.
Basically,
so what I encourage all the parents of elementary children to do is to get a notebook. Get a notebook and call this the golden book, an A5 little notebook, one for each child. And in this notebook, what we do is we write down 5 descriptive praises every day. So just comment on the things they're getting right. Thank you, Susie, for taking your cup from the table to the dishwasher. I'm going to call you my helping hand.
Mm-hmm.
Or I appreciate you bringing in your book bag or your school bag from the car. That's very independent. Or I noticed when your sister dropped her ice cream, you happily shared yours with her. You know, that was mm-hmm. a really kind, generous thing to do. So praise in all areas praise of your life and write it in the Golden Book. With the Golden Book, you then read it to your children at bedtime, and as their head hits the pillow, after you've read the bedtime story, you read the Golden Book, and they feel good about themselves. And what you'll find is as self-esteem increases, cooperation will increase. Then what you can do is share with the school the Golden Book and just say something like, you know, we're finding little Johnny is becoming much more cooperative at home. Can we share with you what we've been doing? So without criticizing the school or telling them they're doing a lousy job and this is what they've got to do and they're getting it all wrong, a really wonderful way is just gently sharing with the classroom teacher what you're doing and what's working at home.
And you are reinforcing his positive behavior. And there's consistency that exists and continuity that exists between home and school as to how one interacts with him, how one approaches, you know, his behavior and focuses on the positive aspects. So that's what I hear out of this technique. We need to take one more brief break, and I'll get right back at you.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
A special thanks to Elaine Halligan, who joins us from London, sharing all of her experiences and her expertise in raising a child who may march to a different drummer. Elaine, how do you protect your child? How do you protect your child when they're in a alien environment?
When they're in a what environment?
Alien or negative environment. How do you protect them? What kind of skills? Mm. You know, am I clear?
It does. Yeah,
okay.
Very clear.
I could tell from the tone of your voice.
No. We're going to go back to the skill we discussed before the break time, which mm-hmm. is descriptive praise. Because the reality is this, is that our kids will experience negativity in society.
Right.
And they will experience, I think you said, an alien environment. They will experience different environments. And they'll experience environments that don't quite work for them. And they will get criticism in real life. Agreed?
Agreed, yes. That's part of life,
real life. We can be as positive as possible at home, but they may not have that positivity replicated in other areas of their life when they leave the home. So here's the thing. Even if the school are not doing descriptive praise and not doing a positive environment, the most important thing is that your child leaves the house in the morning feeling good about themselves.
Okay.
And the only way your child will feel good about themselves is if they're getting lots of messages of positive affirmation from whoever is at home. So if your child leaves the house in the morning feeling high on self-worth and self-esteem, and then they encounter criticism outside of the home, perhaps in a school environment or elsewhere, what happens is they will be able to handle life's knocks far better than if they left the house feeling rubbish about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know whether that answers the question about an alien environment or a negative environment.
Right.
The idea is some children actually struggle with change. So an alien environment that's different to them, it can be quite hard for some special needs kiddies because change is a problem and adaptability and flexibility are skills they'll need. And I think if there is an environment that's unknown to them or a little different, we absolutely have to prepare for success. And we are not very good at that as parents. I spent years, Liz, ambushing my children. Literally not setting them up for success, but kind of taking them to the dentist, knowing Sam hated the dentist, and just thinking, oh, I'll just chance it, and hopefully it'll all be all right when we get there. I'll just give him some sweets to placate him. And always we had to kind of pin him down on the dentist chair, and it was just awful. It was just the most awful scene, and it was all because I didn't prepare him for success. So, two aspects to that answer. If it's an alien environment, lots of setting up for success. And if it's a negative environment, lots of descriptive praise. Your kid leaves the house feeling really good about themselves.
Well, you know, discipline is always a problem. It's a key issue. Yeah. It's a component that must be exercised. It has to be clear. It has to be consistent. It has to be relevant. Share with us how you handle discipline.
Great question, that. We, in the early days, I confess, and it wasn't my proudest parenting moment, is that we used to punish them. And I look back with some of the things we did with deep regret, but I did it because I didn't know any different. And so everything I talk about in the book is about positive discipline. It's not about being that authoritarian parent who's in control. It's not about punishment, because I can guarantee you this, Liz, when we punish our children, punishment doesn't negate the misbehavior. It just leads to more rebellion and more resentment. Mm-hmm. And I think your listeners, any listener out there who's tried to punish a child, send them to the room, put them on the naughty step, this stuff does not work. It lowers self-esteem, and it causes more problems, and it leads to rebellion and resentment. So we had to adopt our discipline to be much more positive. And what we learned in positive discipline is kind of how to be clear on our rules and boundaries. And that's a really, really important part of positive parenting. And it's the firm part, by the way. You know, I've spoken about positivity, but it's really important that actually parents are firm, but not authoritarian firm. Firm by being in charge, but not in control. Okay. So it's about creating what you said originally, I think, that loving connection with your child. That loving connection doesn't mean laissez-faire parenting. It means being firm, being clear on your rules and boundaries. And here's the thing. If children don't follow a rule, we need to deliver what I call a meaningful, relevant consequence, not a punishment. A meaningful, relevant consequence. So I'll give you an example. If a child, I don't know, throws their glass of orange juice on the floor, in anger. They may not have meant to do it, but they did it in anger. A punishment would be sending the child to the room or depriving them of screen time for the rest of the week. That would be a punishment. And we do come up with the most ridiculous punishments, Liz, that are completely unrelated to the misdemeanor.
Right.
That was ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. I've even had clients say to me that because their child's flying dead, they've refused them to go to the birthday party at the weekend. And then it gets to the weekend and you're thinking, oh, my God, I've been told I've got to be consistent. I've got to follow through.
Right.
Whereas, meanwhile, they are desperate for them to go to the birthday party. So those punishments just don't work. And let me tell you, there is no learning. So we say at the parent practice that every misbehavior has a teachable opportunity. It's a teachable moment. So the child who throws the glass of orange juice on the floor, the most meaningful, relevant consequence is they clear up the mess. They get the dustpan and brush. They get a mop. They get a cloth. They get some spray, whatever it is, and they start to clear up the mess. And here's the thing. If a glass is maybe broken, maybe, I'm not saying you do this in all circumstances, but just maybe they may have to contribute towards the cost of replacing that glass. It may be. It depends on the circumstances. And if they say something like to you, oh, I'm so sorry, Mom, I didn't mean to do it, we will kick in immediately with praise and say, Harry, I'm so happy you didn't mean to do that. I'm so glad it wasn't intentional.
Accidents happen.
You absolutely just lost it in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And there's still something you need to do to clear up this mess. What do you think you can do? And so we're always thinking of delivering positive discipline with those relevant consequences. Does that make sense?
Oh, yes. Perfect sense.
Yeah.
But how do parents evolve into this positive parenting? I mean, it's not easy, especially if you have a child who is demanding.
Yeah. So positive parenting is not instinctive.
No.
That's the first thing I'd say. There is absolutely no instinct to parenting at all. People say, isn't parenting instinctive? It's not. It's absolutely not. It's a deeply ingrained state based on the way you were brought up.
Mm-hmm.
And you may have had a very happy upbringing. You may not have had an happy upbringing. And most parents will replicate what their parents did with them. Add into the equation or the formula a child who's got more needs educationally or socially, and there is no instinct about this at all. So it's a really simple answer to this. It needs to be learned. And I would love in society to make positive parenting classes available for everyone. I don't know in America whether you all go running off for your antenatal class, but certainly in Britain, it's the dumb thing that as soon as you're expecting a baby, you register with your local hospital or local group for your antenatal class.
No. Some hospitals may offer that, but that is not something that you encounter on a regular basis, no.
Okay.
Mm-mm.
So in Britain, it's kind of the done thing. It's kind of recognized as a done thing to go and prepare for the birth of your baby and get education. Brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
We'll take that box. Fabulous thing to do.
Mm.
What's not the done thing is to go and seek positive parenting advice. And there may be still a little stigma that positive parenting classes or workshops or any intervention of that sort is for problem families, and nothing could be further from the truth. So to answer your question, how do you start adopting these skills of being positive and being firm with your rules and boundaries and being consistent, which is having a united front, I actually think it's got to be taught a lot of the time. And I think that is a kind of societal problem. We need to see government investing far more resources in making this work available to all.
I'm talking with Elaine Halligan, the author of My Child's Different. Elaine, for the listening audience, where can they get your book?
I think the simplest place for American listeners is Amazon.com.
Okay.
It's easy to access there, and it should be available easily on Amazon.
Well, what do parents do? How did you handle it when your child acts out in public?
I've had many episodes of acting out in public. And I don't know whether you're referring to my low parenting moment, which is in the book, about, do you remember that story about when Sam is on the train and he starts kicking an other passenger?
Oh, yes.
Yes, I do.
Oh, and then you have people who don't understand what's going on.
Sam started one day on a very crowded train in London. He was just overwhelmed, sensory issues, crowded carriage. He started kicking another passenger, which was so embarrassing. And it was clear to anyone who was watching that I had an aggressive child. He looked as if he was dysfunctional, and I did all the things that didn't work. I reprimanded him.
Mm-hmm.
I threatened him. I nagged him. I begged him, and his behavior just got worse. And eventually, this lady who was kind of under attack, let's say, just shouted out to me that what your boy needs is discipline, and a darn good smack will sort him out. And I remember just sitting there feeling so embarrassed, so hopeless. I felt some completely out of control. I ended up standing up in this kind of packed London train. And in London, so much of engaging eye contact with other passengers is really frowned upon. You just put your head down and you don't speak to anyone. That's just the culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I stood up and I heard myself making a speech. And I kind of said that, you know, I'm dealing with a child with difficulties and he's not being a problem. He's having a problem. And I made a plea to everyone and I said, you know, the last thing I'm going to do is smack my child for having a problem. Will you please stop judging me and help me to leave the train at the next station? And what happened next, Liz, was just, I can laugh about it now, but the silence on the carriage was excruciating. And then suddenly, this gentleman pipes up and he says, yeah, leave that poor lady alone. She's doing the best job she can. And in an instant, the whole carriage descended into a heated argument about how to discipline a child. Was I doing the right thing? How little we understand about autism. And they all started arguing about whether smacking was an effective form of discipline. And Sam just kind of sat wide-eyed watching all these adults as if they were in a playground slagging match. And we just got off the train at the next station. And Sam was as quiet as a lamb because I think he suddenly realized the impact of his own behavior on others around him. And that, Liz, was my low parenting moment. So I just wanted to give your listeners the idea that we have all been there big time when our children really embarrass us. The most important thing to do when your children are acting out in public is to be an emotion coach for them. And gosh, I wish I had another hour on this call because there is so much
We'll have to do it again.
Coaching. Mm-hmm. We'll have to do it again. Love you. I love your positive attitude. But emotion coaching is very simply about naming feelings to tame them. So rather than dealing with the behavior when they're acting out in public, if you just look at the tip of the iceberg and don't get beneath the water level, you will never succeed. So if your child is acting out and you reprimand them, punish them, tell them to stop, it absolutely won't work. And what you need to do in that moment is listen to them and validate their feelings. What does that sound like?
Yes, that sounds...
Oh, very quick example. Your child wants sweets. And you just say to him, instead of saying, no, you can't have sweets, you just say to him, I get it, honey. You are really cross with me about this rule that sweeties are only on the weekend. I get it. And you're feeling angry, cross, and frustrated at mommy just now. Mm-hmm. And literally all you do is try and name the feeling in order to tame it. And that's a very quick answer to that question.
In these last 2 minutes, bullying. How do you prepare your child for bullying techniques? Now, we hear a lot about bullying. Uh-huh.
Very quick answer is I would teach them quick riposts. What do I mean by quick riposts? You need to teach your child not to be the victim and to be able to stand up to the bully with some quick riposts. We all know bullies do it in order to get attention. So the worst thing our child can do is if a bully, a simple example says, you're fat, and the child says, no, I'm not. That's a really unkind thing to say. The bully will go more for it.
Mm-hmm.
So if the bully says you're fat, you just teach your children five quick riposts. Very simply, why do you say that? Okay, that's interesting, and that's your opinion. Or a really sassy one that parents may or may not like is, yeah, okay, you tell me I'm fat, that's your opinion. And if I valued your opinion, I would be bothered about that.
Mm-hmm.
Bit sassy. You could say whatever, yeah? Or, yeah, okay, I'm a different shape to you, sure. So we need to teach our children how not to react in the moment. But clearly, when they're upset about it and they come home, we definitely need to emotion coach them and listen and validate their feelings. But the most important thing to teach them is how to stand up for themselves in the playground and not allow the bully to get attention.
I want to extend my sincere thanks and appreciation for you sharing your time. I've been talking with Elaine Halligan, author of My Child's Different. That's it for this hour. Tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Ken Smith.
If you would like to participate in 411 Teen or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. 411 Teen archives are available as streaming audio and as downloads from WFSU.org. Check us out on Facebook.